Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God.
Those elegiac and graceful words closed President Reagan's address to the nation in January of 1986 as Americans grappled with a traumatic loss. Seven crew members of the Challenger space shuttle that included schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe died in an explosion on live television just minutes after the shuttle had left the launch pad. Reagan's team would call in Peggy Noonan, still relatively unknown as a speechwriter, to craft the words the president would say that night. Noonan said later she knew it would be a heavy lift. The president is going to have to do a speech, she recalled, that is aimed at those who are 8 years old, those who are 18, and those who are 80, without patronizing anyone. And he pulled it off. Listen to how Reagan spoke to the school kids who were watching that day.
I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery.
As we reflect on what President Trump said yesterday in Las Vegas to an anguished community, we're also going to talk about the role that presidents play in a nation that's grieving. And I'd like some thoughts or reflections from you. As you listen to some of these excerpts of presidents who lead us in mourning, tell me what you think it's important to hear from a president in that hour. Do we look to the president, whoever he is, for some measure of comfort? Do we look for a message of unity? What are we looking for in this time that we're going through right now again? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-I-M-P-R. Eddie Glaude Jr. is with us. He's a chair of African-American studies at Princeton, where he's also a professor of religion. His newest book is titled Democracy in Black. We find him in Cleveland, Ohio today. Professor, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Always a pleasure. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, and thank you to you, too. Timothy Walch is with us. He's director emeritus of the Hoover Presidential Library and the author of many books on the presidency and vice presidency, and he's with us from Iowa City. And Tim, welcome. It's good to have you on the show as well.
Thanks, Kerry. Great to be back.
I hope first names are okay with everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good.
Absolutely.
Eddie, to go back for a moment to that speech that Reagan gave on the Challenger disaster, I think it's interesting that Peggy Noonan was worried about balancing the president's tone for everyone who was watching and that he was speaking both to the aspirations of a country and to the tragedy that can flow from that. I wonder what you heard in that.
Well, I mean, there, you know, what I heard was this delicate balance that always has to be struck in moments of tragedy. And that is a kind of acknowledgement of the pain of grief, a kind of recognition of the horror of the experience had. And at the same time, to offer resources for how to imagine oneself beyond the moment. And the president is uniquely charged in these instances to do both for the country, a country that is often in these moments, at least prior to these moments, divided, bitterly so. And so I think there is this kind of aspirational dimension to it, as you rightly note. But there's also this really, I think, important attempt to acknowledge the depth of the grief experienced. You have to, the president has to stand in that moment. We talk about Ronald Reagan in that moment, or we could talk about even Barack Obama delivering the eulogy, right, for those folks murdered by Dylann Roof, right? So there's this attempt to kind of offer resources to imagine oneself outside of the moment, but as well as kind of understanding the depth of the grief in it.
Yeah, Tim, I think that phrase that Eddie used to be able to imagine oneself and ourselves collectively in the moment and after the moment is probably what makes these speeches full of import, but also kind of risky. How do you think of it?
Absolutely. And in fact, it is a little ironical in the sense that when Ronald Reagan gave those remarks, he thought he really had failed. He really didn't think he had connected with the American people. And it wasn't until he talked to Tip O'Neill that he realized how powerful the message was. It's also important that the president, the whoever's delivering the remarks, in almost every case it's a president, but occasionally it's others, that they own those remarks, and that Ronald Reagan had a unique gift in being able to take a text and make it his own. So the words came from his heart and his head, not so much just having his eyes reading what he sees and then delivering it as if one is reading a text. And that is vitally important, that the American people believe that not only is their president speaking for them, but that he believes what those words are. There's a fundamental truth in this, in what he is saying. And that's not an easy task. Not every president could do that. And we all know presidents who were successful communicators and those who weren't. And that's what makes a particular difference in a time of grief, but also in a time of war or conflict, which is another time of crisis that presidents are called upon to deliver remarks that codify what the American people believe.
Tim, an interesting historical morsel here. You said that Reagan wasn't sure that the speech had been a hit. I was reading some background on this that said that Frank Sinatra watched it and called, and the message kind of got relayed to, I think he called Peggy Noonan, and the message got relayed to Reagan. And when Reagan heard that Sinatra had liked it, he knew it was a hit.
The chairman says it's a success, and so it was a success. And I don't mean to make light of the speech, but it also shows, again, for a man as successful as Ronald Reagan was as a communicator, that even presidents on occasion have doubts. And so, for example, was the case with Abraham Lincoln delivering the remarks at Gettysburg, which is another time of grief and codification, in which the president wasn't sure that he was successful. And in fact, there's only one brief photograph of the event. It's as if people were dismissive after having listened to Edward Everett talk for an hour. Everett knew that Lincoln's remarks were successful. And what's interesting, I think, too, about remarks that codify a sense of grief is that sometimes they're intended to be read after the fact. And so we obviously read the Gettysburg Address, and it helps codify the losses of the Civil War and the purpose of the Civil War. And we still go back to that space shuttle speech and take from it pearls of wisdom. So these things can grow and have continuing value, particularly for historians and students of American culture.
Jackie says on Twitter, "I look for acknowledging comfort, earnest reassurance, and respectful action during moments of tragedy." Eddie, you mentioned the speech that President Obama gave at the memorial service for the parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina, right, who'd been killed. We have an excerpt of that. And what I think is interesting, I watched the whole thing a couple days ago, and I pulled this part out specifically because you hear the president navigating exactly that divisiveness that you're talking about. He's speaking to where we're at on gun policy, as we've been talking about again in the wake of Las Vegas. He's speaking to race. Let's listen to how he does it, and then we can talk about it.
People of goodwill will continue to debate the merits of various policies, as our democracy requires. There's a big, raucous place America is. And there are good people on both sides of these debates. Whatever solutions we find will necessarily be incomplete. But it would be a betrayal of everything Reverend Pinckney stood for, I believe, if we allowed ourselves to slip into a comfortable silence again.
You're right.
Once the eulogies have been delivered, once the TV cameras move on, to go back to business as usual. That's what we so often do. To avoid uncomfortable truths about the prejudice that still infects our society. To settle for symbolic gestures without following up with the hard work of more lasting change. That's how we lose our way again.
Eddie, what do you hear there?
I hear him reaching for an opportunity to move the nation beyond the context that produced the horrific events in Charleston. And that's a rather convoluted way of making a basic point. But in these moments, you have to, you know, I think, and, again, we need to be very careful. We're not just talking about successful speech. You know, success here has much, much more depth, right? Mm-hmm. That is, he's speaking to the hearts and minds of folks. In these moments, I think it's important that the values that we're supposedly committed to, right, the values that make us, that urge us to reach for our higher, our better selves, certain kinds of excellences, are put forward. And here, in this moment, President Obama tried to do that. And he tried to do it in Newtown. How many times did he try to do it? And each time you had this moment, a kind of a brief moment of unity around the grief, right, the collective grief experienced. And then, tragically, we found ourselves doing exactly what he said we'd do. And that is slipping back into business as usual.
But what you just said about he's reaching to remind us of our better angels, I think a phrase mm-hmm. coined by President Lincoln, maybe at Gettysburg.
Right.
But he's also, the subtext of that is we want to be better, but we wouldn't be here if we had met our aspirations. That's a really tough thing, it seems to me, to figure out how to articulate.
Right. It's always difficult to try to assign blame or to assess moral culpability in these moments.
Right.
Because we're grieving. People are coming to terms with loss, trying to imagine their lives without people in them that they love deeply. And so it's very difficult in that moment, and preachers and rabbis and imams and persons of faith have to do this all the time as they bury our dead, because, interestingly enough, death is an intimate part of what it means to be a human being. It's just on this scale, right? And so there are these moments where you have to kind of deal with the immediacy of the grief, and at the same time, right, offer up an account of why the person is in the coffin.
Right.
Why we find ourselves in this moment where tears seem to be irreconcilable, that we can't be consoled in some ways. And that's always a delicate balance. And, we use the language of success isn't quite the right word, but, the best preachers, the best persons of faith find a way to walk that delicate line.
Tim?
Yes, I mean, Eddie's absolutely right. There's a wisdom that came from experience, and a very sad experience for him. I think that was the 13th of 14 mass shootings for which he was called upon to give remarks. And in this particular case, too, in church, he rose to the occasion. And, of course, this was the eulogy that was kept with Amazing Grace, probably the first time that a president of the United States has raised his voice in song in a public commemoration. And it's hard to find for him the words just spoken that would make the difference. And so he used song. And that's really exceptional. I suspect that those remarks at Charleston will live on much longer than our memory, sad to say, of the actual loss of life on that terrible day.
Let's listen to President Obama singing Amazing Grace in Charleston.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was born, but now
Eddie, What's the meaning of that?
Well, I mean, in some ways, President Obama was trying to stand in the best of the Black church tradition by lifting a hymn, lining it, and having the congregation, the families, and the nation in some ways participate in an experience of worship and an experience of the ritual of sorrow that has in some ways allowed Black people in this country to get to this point, to get to that point, to overcome. The irony, of course, is that a lot of folks after that, like Tim said, thought this was an amazing moment, that it was kind of indicative. It was, some scholars, I think Michael Dyson actually said that, Michael Eric Dyson said it was Obama's blackest moment in the presidency and in his presidency. And I've always kind of wondered, why did he decide to lift the song Amazing Grace as opposed to Thomas Dorsey's Precious Lord? You know, Thomas Dorsey's Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I'm tired, I'm weak, I'm worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, Precious Lord, lead me on. And it's in that kind of moment, that verse, that Dorsey captures what it means for people to have to endure the absurdity, the violent absurdity of white supremacy. But, you know, he decided to lift Amazing Grace, which is about a slaver who comes to understand his own sins. So the debates, this, and I'm not criticizing him in this moment, I'm just saying that, you know, I think Tim's point is really on, really important, that how the those moments of public consolation live afterwards, what they spark, the kinds of debates that emerge, what we read onto them, what we expected of them, how they become in interesting sorts of ways moments in our political life as we try to move forward from the experience of grief and sorrow.
You know, Tim, when you said that some of these speeches are meant to be read later on, I was surprised when I went back to read some of the speeches that President Clinton gave in Oklahoma City, and we'll hear that, and President Obama and President Reagan and others. Some really surprisingly stand the test of the years, and others seem kind of ephemeral of the moment and not historical in a way. And I wonder why there's a difference. You may have given some thought to that.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that is, for example, sometimes it's the power of the place and the moment, as when President Bush stood on the rock pile after 9/11 and said, "I hear you and the rest of the world will soon hear you."
Right.
It's not very prosaic, but it was powerful at the time, and that was what was needed. So place and moment can be just as important as prose, but there are those on occasion that become more important as they live on in a written form. What's interesting is try to imagine, we live in such a time of the immediate moment, you know, the Twitter world. One can only imagine if the founding fathers were Twittering from the Constitutional Convention, or if Lincoln had a laptop on his way to Gettysburg, how that would change things. But it is true that we're so now attuned to the current moment that it makes it difficult to appreciate the time it takes to produce something of such great prose as the Gettysburg Address. And to think he really did that without, he did have some advice, but the truth was he wrote that himself. It is so unusual. The gift of the presidency and the bully pulpit, in part, is not necessarily that you have to be the great mind, but that you have to recognize great minds and that you have to channel those great minds around you and embrace their ideas and to be able to deliver those great ideas. And that's what you see, I think, in Ronald Reagan and to some extent in President Clinton. I think also when we talk about presidents making a decision to say something at the moment that adds luster to what they're saying generally. I remember his remarks at the funeral for Coretta Scott King, where he made reference to her role as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. There's a woman in that casket. Don't create this marble monument This is a living person who has gone. And that's what I think people admire in their presidents, when they show both their compassion but also their personal humanity.
I mean, and Eddie, the humanizing possibility that presidents bring to this as well, for as Tim is suggesting, I mean, with what we've got in Las Vegas, so many people killed. We don't want to lose that sense of the individual. And I want to believe that presidents are thinking about that. I mean, Oklahoma City, the bombing, many people killed, and the horror of what that means to the nation, but not to lose the individual loss either.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. You have to speak to the fact that somebody's child is in the coffin, somebody's husband, somebody's father, somebody's uncle, somebody's best friend is in the coffin, somebody's aunt, somebody's mother, right? Someone who has been deeply loved, someone who has left their footprint on the planet, in this place, in communities, right, is there. And so it seems to me that, you know, you have to speak to the heart, to that deep and abiding connection that has been severed by the reality, by the brutal reality of death. And this is what makes, you know, the consoler in grief so important. We're so divided in so many ways in our daily lives. Just by basic geography, people live in different communities. We go to different schools. We work in different places. I mean, we have our communities, and oftentimes these sorts of tragedies turn us away from our insular lives and allow us to look at each other. And there's a deep sense of empathy that's expressed. So when the president, if the president fails to speak to that collective sense of grief, that failure has serious implications for the very fabric of the nation itself, it seems to me.
Joshua,
maybe I'm overburdening it.
Joshua says on Twitter, Joe Biden's eulogy for the Granite Mountain hotshots. I think these were the firefighters who were killed in that wildfire. Joshua says, expressed how the world felt and addressed the fire community's grief and sorrow. So as you've listened to this conversation with Eddie Glaude Jr. from Princeton and Timothy Walch, Director Emeritus of the Hoover Presidential Library, you know where we're going with this conversation. We're talking about why it is that we turn to a president in a moment of grief and horror, as we've experienced in the wake of Las Vegas and so many times with these mass shootings, why we turn to a president for words of comfort, and how presidents may think about this. And we have some of the historical record. We have some of the recordings of these speeches. And that's what we're talking about this morning. And I'm asking you, as you listen to some of these excerpts of presidents who lead us in mourning, tell me what you, as an American, as somebody who is looking to the president for words of comfort and healing, what you want from that. Do you look for comfort? Do you look for a message of unity? Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And, of course, communicate with me on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. We'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Investigators are having a hard time pinning a motive to Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas. The gunman, Stephen Paddock, led a private life, and people who knew him say they had no sense he was capable of gunning down 58 people. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe says Paddock left few clues. Authorities are trying to piece together information about his gambling habits. The GOP is showing some willingness to consider a restriction on a gun accessory. Senior Republicans on Capitol Hill are expressing openness to the idea of a ban on bump stocks, like the shooter in Las Vegas apparently used to make semi-automatic rifles perform more like fully automatic weapons. The comments from the number two Senate Republican and others are an unusual departure from the GOP's congressional general antipathy to gun regulations. Republicans are focusing on cutting taxes as they look to power a $4.1 billion budget plan through the House today. The budget cuts social programs and agency budgets, but its chief purpose is to set the stage for action later this year on a comprehensive overhaul of the U.S. tax code. Three U.S. soldiers were killed and two others injured in an attack in southwest Niger on a joint patrol with Nigerian troops. U.S. Africa Command says another partner nation soldier also died in the Wednesday attack. The injured are in stable condition and have been evacuated to Germany. And Iraq's prime minister says government forces have retaken the northern town of Hawija from ISIS, one of the militant group's last strongholds in Iraq. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called the news a victory not just for Iraq, but the whole world. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 9:32.
I'm Tom Weber. Governor Mark Dayton will hold the last of 10 town halls tonight to talk about water quality in Minnesota. We're checking in with the governor to see what comes from all these meetings he's held across the state. Then, the pain and psychology of accidentally killing someone. You'll hear from the author of a very compelling recent article about this. All of that at 11.
Coming up on Flyover this Sunday, our national conversation about American identity. We're talking about guns and American identity. What else? We'll open the phone lines at 3 o'clock in our region, nationwide. You'll hear what Americans think across the country, and I hope you'll tune in for that. Guns and American identity in our region at 3 o'clock. I'll see you then.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.
Melania and I thank each and every one of you in law enforcement. In the depths of horror, we will always find hope in the men and women who risk their lives for ours. The mass murder that took place on Sunday night fills America's heart with grief. America is truly a nation in mourning.
That is President Trump and First Lady Melania in Las Vegas yesterday, meeting with the families of victims and talking to first responders. And Tim, President Trump has been called on. I mean, he's only, what, eight or nine months into his presidency. He's been called on to do this in a number of different ways in Houston, in Puerto Rico, now in Las Vegas. It sounds to me like a somewhat uneven performance so far. I'm interested in how you view it.
Yeah, I think compared to other presidents, this is a difficult task for President Trump. This is not his natural form of communication. And I think he understands that he has to read from a script and express compassion. And I'm not, criticizing him or attributing any other motive to what he's doing. But normally he speaks contemporaneously. He uses a fair amount of acrimony in most of his remarks or personal point of view. Sad to say, because that's not the normal pattern of speech you hear from him. So comforter is not his normal role. It seems awkward and unnatural compared to the Donald Trump that we might see on the political stump. And then, of course, he gets into awkward situations, as he did in Puerto Rico, where I think he was trying to lift up their spirits, and it sounds as if he was kind of promoting his own administration. So I don't think this will ever be a natural role for President Trump. However you feel about his politics or whatever else he does, and that will be a challenge. So in going back and looking at his remarks many years from now about Las Vegas or about Houston or even the Puerto Rico remarks, I think they're not going to rate high among all those comments or assessments of other presidents.
Let me grab a call here from Maggie in Elko. Hey, Maggie, what do you look to a president for at a time like this?
Yes, I was in regards to this disaster. There was a preacher who spoke after the Las Vegas shooting, and to paraphrase him, he said it's not the disaster itself, but the actions that we take afterward to overcome that disaster and to lift each other up as a nation, as a community. And that's what I look to the president for. I look for the way that he you know, is guiding us as a nation to come together and to move past that disaster and probably, you know, in ways that we can prevent those disasters from happening again. And as Peggy Noonan succinctly put it, you know, the president's audience is every age of citizen. And I think that's really important to remember when the president delivers a speech. You know, he needs to unite all of us and guide all of us, or, you know, he or she.
I'm so glad you brought up the, I heard that too, and it might have been in a Morning Edition story, the minister who spoke to this. Eddie Maggie's absolutely right. He crystallized this with but a few words, this helplessness and despair, and the reason that there is a way forward after this. I have to say I felt uplifted when I heard his words.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, it was beautiful. I heard those words as well. And, you know, it's about what kind of life will we live to honor the dead?
Right.
What do we do? What do we do to ensure that their death wasn't in vain, even if it was senseless? Right. And I think this is important in so many different ways as people manage and deal with their grief. Because grief, what comes with grief is trauma. We're traumatized. In some ways, we've been experiencing a national, ongoing trauma. It's like we've been binge-watching disaster in the country. And, you know, President Trump has failed miserably. And this has nothing to do with my disagreement with his politics. I think, I believe, and I should say this, and I know I think he's a narcissist. And one of the key features of a narcissist is that they lack empathy. And so to go to Puerto Rico and to shoot paper towels as if you're shooting three-pointers to people who have lost, many people who have lost everything, and to not express the kind of language of empathy that they needed in the midst of that disaster, or to not visit folks in Houston in the way that you should, and to kind of just simply use it as a time to talk about how great their administration is doing. We see something different in Las Vegas. Somebody, I think he tried and somewhat succeeded in showing his deep concern and care. But in other moments, I think his own personal limitations, because I think Tim was suggesting, evidenced themselves. And I think it's like a bad preacher who doesn't quite send someone home properly. It leaves something bitter at the back of the throat.
I mean, one of the things you're saying, yeah, Eddie, is that you don't hear genuine empathy in the way he's relating to, you know, individuals, whether it's in Puerto Rico or Houston. You heard some of that in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely. And, you know, for me, as an African American, as a person of color, right, I shouldn't jump to this conclusion, but I did. I was like, what's the difference here?
Right.
What is the consistent difference in those two communities? Right. And you know, I mean, in Puerto Rico, his response to Puerto Rico was just horrible. And, to people, you know, to people that have lost everything and have lost loved ones, to hear the president of the United States speak in that way, was just simply just salt in wounds to my mind.
Tim?
Yes, I want to get back to what Eddie said and Maggie said about this idea of going forward, which I think is a fundamental part of the grieving process, and really harken back to Lyndon Johnson, whose prose is not necessarily memorable following the death of John F. Kennedy, except for two words, or three words, I suppose, let us continue. The idea that we continue to go forward in spite of our loss, that we value that person and the way we honor that person, is to take those things that they held precious and to see them through to their fulfillment. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that the Kennedy program would have ever found fulfillment had it not been for Lyndon Johnson's determination to carry it forward domestically. Yeah. So in that sense, we see that Lyndon Johnson's comfort was in action. And what we crave in Puerto Rico and Houston and so many other cases is take action. We want Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey to, you know, reintroduce their registration legislation. And we want to do something about the bump stock program. We need to say is these people should not have died in vain the way Lincoln did at Gettysburg.
call here from Joanne in Rochester. Hi, Joanne. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say some of the positive ideas that people have had, this is so great to hear, but I want to switch it to what I don't want to hear.
Sure.
The over-the-top shoot from the hip, we're going to get those guys that can't be actually fulfilled. When President Bush responded to 9/11, my heart just sank because he was promising a war that couldn't end.
That's interesting, Eddie. And I think that moment, and Tim has talked about this too, that moment on top of the rubble of 9/11 was basically heard around the world. I think it was extemporaneous too. I don't think anybody wrote that for him. Didn't sound like
I don't think so either. But, you know, I mean, I think this is an extraordinary point. You know, how we respond to grief and sorrow, right, is, you know, you know, there's always the worry that there's the call for more carnage, the call for revenge, and somehow, you know, the gaping hole that's left can be filled, right, by exacting, you know, a certain kind of justice, right, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. So in those moments, I think going back to something I said early on and echoing Lincoln, who was echoing, you know, philosophers of virtue, right? How do we, in moments of death, you know, and grief and loss, reach for our higher excellence or better angels, right? How do we imagine ourselves in a better light, and not to kind of succumb to the darkness that often hovers when we're facing loss, unimaginable grief. Right. And this was what was so powerful about Charleston, remember, in the midst of mm-hmm. what framed President Obama's eulogy were these amazing moments. I couldn't do it, I don't think, of these family members extending forgiveness.
Oh, my gosh. Right. It was
right. Trying to get us to reach for our higher selves, right, our better angels in those moments. So I hear the caller in that moment. We don't want to descend into some kind of ugliness in the face of this, as people go out and buy more guns, as people declare that, you know, gun sales are skyrocketing, as folks worry that folks are going to take away their guns and this sort of thing, you would hope that we would, in fact, in the face of death, imagine ourselves differently and we would be better, right?
But Tim, I really understand what motivated President Bush on that day. We'd been taken by so unawares, we were embarrassed and shocked and grieving and horrified. And I think he felt like the American spirit was, this will not stand.
You need to have that, but look how carefully crafted, for example, FDR's remarks were in the request for a declaration of war against the Japanese, or Woodrow Wilson at the time of the First World War, that we have to be careful when we declare that we will not stand for such violence against us, to declare that we are fighting back for a higher purpose, for a moral order. There was, in 1941, John Ford was asked to produce a series of films to explain to the young men why we were going to war, why we fight. Mm-hmm. Because we, as Americans, don't fight for the sake of vengeance. We fight for the sake of returning to a moral order that is of a higher nature, so that one only seeks that kind of retribution to restore the order that we feel is called for in the natural order of things. So that's where we can't lash out. I think we have to say this cannot stand, and we will go forward and produce a better world.
I wanted to play some of the remarks from President Clinton in Oklahoma City. That's the bombing. Again, this was a nation at that time shocked by what somebody was able to pull off, the kind of carnage that they were able to wreak. And President Clinton comes in and he's talking about that shock and horror, and he's talking about the implications of this. And then he turns to this. Listen.
To all my fellow Americans beyond this hall, I say, One thing we owe those who have sacrificed is the duty to purge ourselves of the dark forces which gave rise to this evil. They are forces that threaten our common peace, our freedom, our way of life. Let us teach our children that the God of comfort is also the God of righteousness. Those who trouble their own house will inherit the wind. Justice will prevail.
You know, Tim, what I heard when I listened to that a couple days ago wasn't them, us and them. It was, we'd better look within ourselves to find this. It was beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, I'm thinking back, in fact, just now looking at the words that Robert F. Kennedy delivered at the time of the announcement of the death of Martin Luther King. And that whole aspirational goal of saying, in effect, the vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together. We want to improve the quality of our life. We want justice for all human beings who abide in our land. Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man, to make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people. It's, again, that, as Eddie referred to, the better angels, aspire to the better angels, and rather than seeking the dark side, to make a reference to Star Wars. But, you know, the idea here is to use a terrible tragedy and to make something good of it, if I can use that term. That's a crude way of putting it. But to make ourselves better for that horrible experience, that Job comes through on the other side.
Hmm. Eddie?
That's great. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful point that, you know, in these moments, unjustified suffering can be ministerial to good, that they can actually lead us to see ourselves and our current arrangements differently. But I think, Carrie, your point is really important here, is that in that moment, President Clinton didn't reach for melodrama, right, in the sense of, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, right, that there's an evil in us that we have to come to terms with, that you know, we're, and I think this is really important, and maybe I'm reading something into those words, but in these moments, we can't just simply say that the evil is over there, right? We have to see this as a kind of a part of who we are and what we've allowed, what we've sanctioned in our silence, and so that's that delicate balance, right, of consoling, of addressing the grief, of articulating aspiration, an aspiration of us reaching for our better selves or better angels, and to understand our own culpability in those moments, in the moment, right? And that's, sometimes it's really hard to do. People don't want to hear that in those moments. Right. But the best eulogies, the best homegoing services, the best presidential moments are often moments that contain an element of all of those, of all of these things.
I'll tell you what else struck me here, Tim, was listening to that eulogy that President Clinton gave and how terribly relevant what he was talking about is for today. We are in some ways in a very similar space all these years later.
Yes, there's no question about it. There's that a little bit of the sense that we're sort of treading water. I think that the things that people also want from a president in a speech like that, in addition to the compassion and the empathy, is a sort of sense of order. Why these people at this time? There's that quality that I always refer people to a book by Thornton Wilder called The Bridge of San Luis Rey, where people die as a result of the collapse of a bridge, and it's why these people at this time. And you realize that this particular shooter in Las Vegas had actually targeted a festival a week earlier. Perhaps that was going to be the festival. But now it's this festival this particular week and these particular people being in that place at that time. We historians certainly crave order. There's a logic to what happened, and this seems so illogical. And that is as big a challenge for a president or anyone to explain to us why me or why them, why my loved one Because as you said earlier, these for each of these families, this is as traumatic and consequential event as the birth of that individual. These are universal experiences to all humankind, life and death. But in that moment at that time, there can't be any more cataclysmic an experience.
Tim and Eddie, I really hope that for everybody who is listening along with this, this was as meaningful for them as it was for me. I really thank you both for taking some time to do this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks, Eddie. Good to be with you guys.
Hey, good to be. Same here.
Eddie Law, Jr., Chair of African American Studies and a Professor of Religion at Princeton, and Tim Walch, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in Iowa City.